Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Joe Lewis, and we are going to be discussing Startide Rising by David Brin, which won the 1984 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining me.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. I've been listening to your show for about a year now, so I'm very happy to be a part of it.
Nice. Yeah, no, the pleasure is all mine. And you are my third Australian guest, I believe.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. There must be some sort of reason for that. Maybe not. I feel like Australians are overly represented in a lot of things. I'm not sure why that is.
Well, you are my first guest from Queensland. My two previous guests were both from New South Wales. So,
Okay. The local pronunciation is Queensland.
Queensland. Okay. You learn something new every day.
There you go.
So, Joe, why don't you tell my listeners a little about yourself, kind of some of your background as a science fiction fan?
Okay. I think my journey started as a kid. I think my dad forced me to read The Hobbit. And then beyond that, I kind of started to find my own way. I really like Star Wars. I know that's what I think most of your guests have said. But then moving on from that, I kind of found my way as a teenager into stuff like Dune. And then started to dig a little bit deeper before, similar to your story, getting sidetracked with university and then life, and then only recently coming back to it in probably the last 3 or 4 years. And so really diving into the sci-fi from there. And I think a big struggle of being a sci-fi, maybe not fan, but reader or participant, is that when you move on from literature, like I did at university, and start looking into things like film, I think there's a really big divide in the quality between sci-fi books and sci-fi movies. And I think that divide is one of the things that caused me to walk away, I guess, because I was really hesitant, even around people that were excited about the same things that I was. I'd be very hesitant to say that I was somebody like a sci-fi fan. I guess I still am, because the stigma that is attached to it is not what I would want to hold up for myself, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a podcaster, I started that when I left uni. So I was looking for a show to do. My degree was in something creative, and I wanted something creative to do outside my professional life. And so I said, let's start a podcast. And the first thing that came up was a children's television show, because that might have been interesting. So we did two years of a podcast on Around the Twist, which is an Australian television show, very popular for being outside the norm. It's kind of like a surrealist thing. And then we did a couple of years doing a fan theories podcast. Now, next year, we've got a new show coming on, but we can talk about that at the end if you like.
Nice. And this is with like a group of people, or?
Most of my podcasts, I've had 4 or 5 total now, but most of my podcasts have been with a co-host that I went to school with. And so we've remained friends. Okay. And even though, you know, I think it's a heated relationship, but I think that that's good for podcasting. You can argue with each other and it can be all right. So, but yeah, that's where we're at with that.
Well, that's cool that you've kind of changed topics and changed kind of lanes as you've progressed in your friendship and in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, at the end, let's go ahead and circle back to talking about your forthcoming podcast and, you know, kind of when I ask you, where can people find you, you can drop that information.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Did you get a chance to look at how many Hugo winners you've read?
I did. So I think that I'm sitting at probably less than half of yours at the moment. I've got 14 and 16, if you consider the retros, which I know you do. But I think most of them are from the 80s, which is kind of a bit weird. I found it very hard, especially as somebody who's come back to sci-fi in the last few years. I found it very difficult to keep up with what's topical. And I think most of my reading has focused on stuff like this that we're about to talk about, like stuff in the 80s, stuff that seems familiar, kind of grounds me to what led me to sci-fi in the first place, like space opera type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which this is.
Yes. Yeah, very much. So yeah, I'm at 40 now, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think on one of the recent ones, I feel like I'm on the downslope now because I'm more than halfway.
Yeah.
So
the end is in sight.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much. So talking a little bit about this book before we get into the kind of formal non-spoiler section, why this book?
Okay, well, when you first put out the call for guests, I had a look at the list, and most of my favorites had already been taken. So I was looking for Dune and Euromancer and Hyperion, books like that. And then I had heard about the Uplift trilogy, and so I was excited to read it. And I'm not a big fan of rereading things. I like to kind of keep pushing my boundaries. And so I chose the Uplift series. And then I think I messaged you with the third book, which I thought was the first. And you came back and said, oh, that's a pretty big commitment to read three books. And I was kind of flustered and was like, oh, I didn't realize this was the third. And then and we ended up on the second because the first book didn't win. So that's kind of how we ended up here. And I think I'm pretty glad that we did. After reading the first book, I was kind of like, oh, like what have we got ourselves into here? But then the second one has definitely turned around for me.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be interested to talk about that for both of us. So this is a first time read for you?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I just assumed that this was, it probably was in one of the emails that we had back and forth that you had been wanting to read this one. But I just assumed most of my guests will, pick one that they've read, 100 times. And there's been a couple times where it's been a first time read. But it's cool to have another first time reader perspective this time.
Mm. It's interesting because I've heard the name a lot, but definitely not as much as you hear those other books, like I mentioned, the other Hugo winners, like the Hyperions and the Neuromancers and the Dunes of the world. But it definitely has this kind of place in the greater consciousness where occasionally you hear it mentioned, usually alongside David Brin, but very occasionally on its own or when it's compared with other books, other more recent books, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I've had several guests who I usually ask people, throw out a few titles just in case, we get the streams crossed and somebody else has requested at a similar time. And I've had three or four guests who had Startide Rising or The Uplift War on their lists.
Oh.
But ended up, I even had one, my guest Lisa Schmeiser, who did Neuromancer. Originally, we were going to do Startide Rising. So. And then she was able to talk somebody else out of Neuromancer, and so we switched.
Well, I'm sorry to steal it from Lisa.
Nope. It was still up for grabs. So why don't we start moving then into the non-spoiler discussion of the book? And we were talking before we started recording, right? There's lots of bits of this that you could consider spoilers for, kind of the whole series. But I feel like there's some basic levels of the concept of the Uplift series that we're just going to have to talk about. And so people will have to be okay with that. And, it's kind of unavoidable.
Yeah. And I think the interesting part about that as well, as somebody who came into this as a first time reader, I didn't realize that the first two books of this trilogy, at least, are fairly disconnected. Like there's plot elements, I think, in this book that spoil fairly major things of the ending of the first book. But outside of that, there's no recurring characters. There's a couple of like mentions or cameos, I guess. But beyond that, the plot is very disconnected. And it's kind of the way I was thinking about it when I was reading this book is that the first book, Sundiver, really feels more like a prologue.
Yes.
Did you get the same feeling?
I did get the same feeling because that one, and kind of by its nature, right, we have to spoil a little bit of it, or at least the fact that you kind of get to the end of that book and a lot of stuff has happened, but like the major thing that they were trying to do, we don't really get much detail on.
Yeah.
I found that a little frustrating because I'm like, oh, hey, I want to know more about, these aliens that you were trying to contact. And I, at least as far as I remember, I don't remember really getting to know that much about them because there's a lot of twists and turns and double crosses in that book.
Yes. It feels very much like it is a first novel, but it feels very much like a first novel that somebody wrote when they were still weighed down heavily by their influences. So there's a lot of like spy type things, and it feels very, very much like the main character is this unstoppable spy who can do anything and be anyone he wants to be. And he's involved in all these machinations, but he always comes up on top. And Startide Rising is a very different book.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is. Well, why don't you try and give as non-spoilery as possible a kind of elevator pitch or short synopsis of the book?
Sure. So Startide Rising is a book that takes place in the future where humans have discovered the technology to be able to uplift species. And whenever we say uplift in this podcast, we're going to be talking about giving a species sentience. So like a human level intelligence, essentially.
Right.
So humans have uplifted dolphins and monkeys, or apes, I guess. And they have begun to journey out in space where they have interacted or met for the first time other alien species. And then the humans find out that a part of this enormous universe, the ties that hold it all together is made up of this uplift technology. Everyone's kind of surprised that humans were able to uplift two species on their own, because in this universe, prestige is tied directly to the number of races that you've uplifted as a species.
Right.
So humans have uplifted two. They're called client races, and so they're a patron of two. And also humans are a little bit interesting because we don't know who has uplifted us. So every other species can kind of tie their way all the way back to essentially the progenitors, the people who started it all. But humans don't have that next link. And so people are very suspicious of humans. That's kind of the setup to the universe that this takes place in. And so a small ship filled with, it's like a first-time dolphin crew, have traveled out to kind of one of these fringe areas of the universe that is not really known much about, at least to humans, and they have interacted, they've found a derelict space fleet, and they sent out a message to Earth to say, oh, look, we've found something. It was intercepted by everybody else. Everyone else thinks it's these fabled progenitors, and then chases these humans to, well, humans and dolphins and a monkey to a water planet, which is very convenient for the dolphins because they can swim around, but then for the rest of the book, we're faced with a siege where everyone in the universe is trying to get this small spaceship and whatever they've taken from the derelict fleet and the location of this fleet. That's
right.
That's pretty much in broad strokes the story of this book.
Cool. That was good.
It was a little bit long.
No. I think that's completely appropriate because you kind of had to set up the concept of the series and then drop in a, you know, it was much shorter on the actual plot of this book.
Yeah.
So I always like to try and kind of figure out, like further reading for people, or if people like a certain series, you know, who would like this book, can you think of any comps for this book or this series?
I can. And I think the biggest one for me was, I think it's the main link that led me here, was that, Mass Effect, the video game series, is very much inspired by this series. And, even down to the point where they use, progenitors. It's all about the progenitors. Where did the progenitors come from? These people that were the first to uplift people. And this sprawling universe of all different types of people that were uplifted from different things. So that's the biggest influence. So if you like Mass Effect, this is definitely something that will strike your fancy. Then I guess Planet of the Apes is an obvious comparison.
Yes.
Something like Children of Time is another more recent comparison. And I guess anything space opera-y, so any of those books that I mentioned earlier. But on a planetary level and kind of like a crew level as well, because we're really just faced with this crew and how do they get out of this enormous like universe engulfing situation that they've got themselves into.
Right, right. Yeah, the one comp that I thought of was Prometheus.
Oh, yeah.
It very different in tone, of course, but there's the kind of idea of looking for the progenitors of the human race.
Mm.
So let's kind of talk about overall thoughts, because it's a first time read for both of us. Like you mentioned before, you know, I actually listened to Sundiver. I bought the audiobook and I listened to it, and I was talking to my friend Colin. I'm like, this isn't doing anything for me. I'm really not. Like, I was not very interested in it at all. And it got to the end and I thought, okay, I mean, that was interesting. And it's fascinating world building. You know, the whole idea of uplift is something that I could, like, you and I could have an hour long discussion just about uplift, right?
Yeah.
I just didn't feel like the plot of Sundiver really necessarily justified that, you know, or, I don't know. And like, the uplift is such a big idea. And then Sundiver just was a little book. Somehow it didn't quite measure up to the idea. And it sounded like you had a similar experience.
That's exactly what I thought when I was reading it too. It's kind of this weird spy type plot set on a galactic level where humans are trying to investigate these things that are happening in the sun, where they think that they might be progenitors. And so it's like this whole big thing that turns out to be not very much, which is very disappointing to read. And I think a lot of the small threads, that the things that really hold your interest, he doesn't really develop other than just like kind of sprinkling in that world building. Like we get mentions of the whale dream, which we talk about in this book, in the first one. And I thought that was going to be a major part of Sundiver, but it's not. And so all those little interesting sprinkles of world building that you were kind of hinting at in Sundiver, they're what become the pillars of Star Tide Rising.
Right. I did not remember that the whale dream had had roots back in Sundiver. So when I came to Star Tide Rising, I thought, okay, well, you know, that set up the universe. Now the universe is there and we can build on that. And like you mentioned earlier, these books aren't very connected other than the fact that they're set in the same universe. And this one is quite some time later. I get the impression that the, what was his name? John? I can't remember what the name of the character was.
John Demois?
That's what it was. Yeah. Demois. Jacob Demois.
Jacob.
I think we get the mention that he's still alive. And so it had to be within whatever limit of human lifespan there is 500 years in the future. But I got to this one and really kind of hoped that it would pick up the ball and run with it. And it did, I guess, but it really didn't work very well for me. And I'm not sure why. And so I want to hear your thoughts about it and we can have a discussion and you can try and talk me into regarding it more highly.
Absolutely. So we'll start off with the non-spoilery stuff, I guess, and talk more about characters and ideas.
Yeah, just kind of your overall impressions of the book.
Well, I liked it. And I think for reasons that I was saying earlier, those nuggets of that were found in Sundiver are built into big ideas here. So that dolphin idea is very, very interesting to me. And the way that it plays out in this book is kind of one of the main conflicts of the book. So you have a dolphin crew. So it's kind of strange to explain to somebody that hasn't read it, but essentially they're dolphins that have inhuman intelligence. They're called neo-dolphins or neofins, and they have the ability to smile and they have similar cognitive behavior to humans. But there's a big clash in that development. So dolphins exist in this mental state, which is referred to as the whale dream. So we talked a little bit about that, but basically what that means is it's kind of this poetic and dreamlike state of being that cetaceans, is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah.
It's the state that the cetaceans, they inhabit in their primal state. So our version of dolphins and our versions of whales, etc., exist in this dreamlike poetic state, which I don't think is a real thing. But it's described fairly in depth in this book. And so they've moved from that state into a human-like intelligence. And there's a big clash between the cognitive, I guess, is it right brain or left brain? The cognitive side.
Oh, I don't remember.
And the other side. So the clash between the two, this poetic dreamlike state that the dolphins are used to living in, or that their primal selves are used to living in, and now this cognitive world of the humans. And the way that that's kind of explained is really interesting, because they're animals that don't have opposable thumbs, they're animals that don't have fingers, they can't manually interact with things as much. So their state of reality is much more in blocks than ours is, because ours is defined by things that we can action. So there's a pen in front of me. I can use that to write, whereas the dolphin state of being would be, I'm in this room and there's not much water, and that they would come up with a kind of a more metaphorical version of reality rather than our solid cognitive state. And I found that conflict very interesting.
Yes. And I mean, like, by way of positives for this book, even though I didn't love it, and by the way, I'm on an island about this. When I've posted on social media or even talked with people about the fact that I'm reading this book, they're like, oh, that's one of my favorites. And it sucks to be the person who's like, yeah, I mean, it seems okay, but Uplift is such a big idea. And then the idea of what would Uplift look like for a species that has a very different evolution than humans, right? You can kind of go, okay, humans and chimps, you can see how sapient chimps or neo chimps and humans could relate to each other better than humans and dolphins. And I really like that, what you were talking about the idea of the kind of dueling natures of the dolphins, because you have a couple parts in this book where a dolphin almost reverts to the primal side and has to be snapped back out of it. And it's this humiliating thing.
Mm. It's very, very interesting. And I like how he's zoned in that uplift idea. You're saying it's a massive, massive concept, which it is. And he's applied it directly to dolphins. We get a little bit about it, about other alien cultures and about the interactions with neo-chimps, etc. But it's very much focused on the dolphins here. And that duality between cognitive reality and a more dreamlike reality. And there's several characters that kind of show different versions of that. Like the captain of the ship is a dolphin, and his journey through that conflict is very different to some of the other dolphins. Mm-hmm. He's kind of on the reverse flip of the dolphins that are fighting against their primal natures, which is kind of a very interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I will say, finishing off my overall thoughts about it. Mm. I am still looking forward to reading The Uplift War. I've actually heard that it's the best of the first series, which it's not always the case, right? Sometimes the first book is the one that nails it, and then it's diminishing returns. And so I'm excited by the fact that people say, oh yeah, that's the one where it's really, really good.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have it on my bookcase, and I intentionally didn't read it so that I would be able to have a more accurate discussion of this one, because I feel like often my impressions would be overshadowed by the next one.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to think about anything else we can talk about before getting into spoilers, but I feel like it's going to be pretty difficult if we don't just dive right in.
Well, we can talk a little bit about the pecking order of the universe. It's not too spoilery. Okay. But essentially, it's kind of this interesting system where, like we were saying before, if you have uplifted a certain number of races, you have more prestige than somebody else. And if you have been uplifted by a different race, you owe them a certain number of thousands of years in essentially slavery. So your race is enslaved to that race for several thousand years to pay back the fact that you were uplifted. And so it kind of creates this interesting set of chains or families or houses where this race has uplifted this other race and a whole bunch of races, and then they fall into like a subcategory of races that were uplifted by a bigger race. And so you have these big chains, and because humanity doesn't have or doesn't know who their patrons were, they're really awkwardly placed in this mix. So they have prestige higher than another race of their age. So there's races that are really, really old, millions and millions of years old. And then we have humanity who don't have a patron, and now they're sitting, like trying to sit at the same table with these races that have been uplifted by many, many. The chain goes back very far, and also they themselves have uplifted three or four races. And that creates this interesting conflict where humans are these rogues. Nobody really likes them, but they're kind of doing things that haven't been done for a long time because everybody's reliant on this really ancient technology that hasn't really evolved over the millions of years that this uplift chain has been going on.
Right. Yeah, that kind of gets you into the discussion of the library, right?
Yes.
Where you have this shared corpus of knowledge that all of these ancient species have. And so it's like they have a playbook that they all go by, and the humans who've only recently even had access to the library do things, you know, a little more instinctively, it seems like. And so that's one of the things I feel like that is presented pretty well, that those other older patron species and even some of the client species just kind of look at the humans as an upstart, right? Who they don't do things right. It reminds me of when you have like in baseball or another sport where you have a rookie who comes up and he's super brash, and the veterans all just want to push him down and teach him to play the game the right way. You know, stop showing people up. You know, you got to pay your dues, act like you've been there before. And I have no patience for that, actually.
Yeah.
And so here, I don't really have a lot of sympathy for those older species, because I feel like the whole idea that you're going to uplift another species, which is absolutely a good thing to do, right? I mean, well, not absolutely. And I do want to talk about the ethics of uplift at some point. But the idea that you're only doing that essentially because then you get them for, I think it was 100,000 years was the standard indenturement. And yep. That's a really, really long time. And you can kind of understand why humans would go, well, look, I mean, we can trace our civilization back a couple of thousands of years, and we're only 100 years or less past, well, I guess there are a few hundred years past enslaving each other, and kind of going, we don't really want to do that. That wasn't cool when we did it to each other, and we don't want it to do it to a client race. Why would we do that? And that pisses people off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely like a racism message, yes. And kind of like a slavery message, and a message about like how much is somebody worth. And because you have given somebody intelligence, does that give you the right to own it? Which I think is an interesting dilemma, because I feel like there would be a fair amount of people that would argue that yes, it does. So if you think about like lab experiments on mice or things like that, if we suddenly were able to make super mice, does that mean that we get to enslave those mice? Maybe.
Right. Yeah. And that's where you get into some of the ethics. Like if every species has the potential to be brought up to sapiency, it makes it harder to eat them. The ethics of meat eating then would come into that as well.
Yeah.
I think we ought to just go ahead and go into spoilers.
Okay.
One thing that I found, I guess this isn't even spoiler talk really, but in both Sundiver and in Star Tide Rising, there are so many names that are similar. I guess especially in Star Tide Rising. In Sundiver, one of the problems I had was some of the race names were very similar. And I can't remember them all off the top of my head. I remember they're the Pila, and I thought there was another one that was similar to that. Now I can't think of it. But in this one, the dolphin names, you know, you have like Crydike and Kapiru and all these names that kind of have either similar like sibilance to them or almost rhyme, to where in this book in particular, the chapters are short and from particular characters' perspectives, and that shifting perspective and the names that were similar made it difficult for me to kind of keep track of who was doing what. And that was, I think, maybe on a reread, I wouldn't have that problem because I will have like kind of gotten an idea of, okay, Kipiru is this one, and Hikai is another one, and Crydike is the one who's wounded. So that was, I guess that was part of why the book didn't totally work for me, just because I kept having to kind of go back and go, wait, now who was doing that? So
yeah. Yeah. I'm incredibly grateful. I don't know if your copy has it, but mine has a glossary and cast of characters in the first few pages.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I was flicking back to that every second page.
Yeah, I didn't always do that. I was switching. I was kind of alternating between reading in print and listening, because I had the audiobook as well. And so there were times where I'd listen to a chapter and then I'd go back and read it because I wasn't following it on audio. I don't know. It's one of those things where if you leave it for a couple of days, it's easy to kind of lose the thread of it. And I feel like this would be a better book to like read on a plane where you had several hours to read a big chunk of it. But I didn't have that experience this time.
Yeah, I have to disagree with you a little bit though, because I kind of liked the way that similar names were grouped. So whenever you have kind of one of those rhyming kind of Japanese or oceanic names, you kind of know that it's a dolphin, or if you have like a very plain vanilla, like Anglic name, it's a human. And if you have a name that's kind of a bit different, then it's probably a different race. So even without flicking back, it makes it a little bit easier to go, okay, this person's a dolphin, which kind of helps out the fact that it's very difficult to, I imagine it's very difficult as David Brin trying to make these dolphins feel like people, but also dolphins. And I think that's probably one of the biggest achievements of the book, the fact that I could recognize these characters as empathetic people, but also being different from humanity.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that worked better for you. So, so like you mentioned, right, in the non-spoiler discussion.
Yeah.
There's the action that's going on down on Kithrip, right, which is this water world. Mm. And that's got dolphins and the one chimp and several humans, right?
Yep.
Meanwhile, up in space, you have the Galactics. And up there, you had any number of other species. And I found that a little bit bewildering. It was really just a couple of groups that we ever had point of view characters for. Mm. But I never really got very interested in what the Galactics were doing. And so it's kind of like that half of the book. I was just like, I want to know what they're doing down on the planet. I want to know what's going on down there.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
That's always the issue when, if you have plot and, you know, an A plot and a B plot. If the B plot doesn't work for you, then that makes it a tough read.
Mm. I think it's interesting as well, because a lot of that stuff that you spend with the space fleet, it's all kind of, most of it's world building, but then a little,
yes.
Like very little of that battle actually impacts anything that ultimately happens, because there's really only like two or three groups yes. that were ever dominant in that space battle. And that only comes into play like right at the very end of like the third act of the book. So like flicking back to them, like you said, takes your focus away from what's actually happening and doesn't really do anything to advance any conflict or go further than just, oh, these are some people and they're fighting these other people.
Right, right. I will say that in terms of the parts of the book that worked best for me, I did enjoy when the kind of A plot and B plot came together as the humans and the dolphins. What was the name of the ship? Streaker.
Yep.
When they had pulled Streaker into the, I think, Thenanin ship and took off, and they were trying that, what did they call it? Trojan horse, something Trojan horse.
Seahorse?
Trojan seahorse, that's right. when there was that chase at the end, that I found very compelling, very exciting. So that was good.
It's a little bit uncomfortable to talk about, but did you want to talk about some of the like cultural and sexual boundaries that are depicted in the book?
I don't have anything in particular written down on that, so fire away.
Okay, well, I'm not usually somebody who gets upset about these things, because you say a lot on the show, these books are artifacts of the time that they were written.
Yes.
But I think it's fairly interesting in this book. There's a dolphin character who is acting very uncomfortably towards a female human character.
Okay. Now that you mention it, I know where you're going.
so he's kind of like teasing her, and he's kind of sexually aggressive towards her. And she is obviously very uncomfortable with this. And everyone's kind of like, oh, he's just playing. Just like leave him alone. Like if you ignore him, he'll go away, which is kind of like what you would expect from the 80s, like horrific if anyone was to do that now, but horrific, like it's kind of just what they would say in the 80s. But then there's another aspect to that as well, which he kind of hints at, where there's a line where David, I think the character reflects, and he says, oh, this is a tradition that has gone on for hundreds of years, like the relationship between dolphins and female humans. And it's kind of weird.
Right.
And interesting, yes. But also kind of a bit offensive as well.
Right. Yeah. That is one of those things that, you know, I have pretty good memories of the 80s. I don't know how old you are. So, but
no, I got 6 months of the 80s.
Okay. Okay. So you're similar age to my co-host on Take Me to Your Reader. But, in the 80s, I remember, you know, kind of the statement, boys will be boys. Right. And that just does not fly anymore. Turns out we don't have to put up with that kind of behavior. We can stand up to it and say, no, that's not appropriate.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, because it's like he was trying to say something with that. But I just can't quite work out exactly what it is. Like, is he saying that there's a special relationship between dolphins and women?
Right. I guess maybe his idea is that when you look at dolphin trainers, that maybe they're mostly female in terms of the demographic, but I'm not certain that that really works out.
No, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is a little weird. And you know, the idea that somehow that relationship is special, because of course, like the kind of stimulation that a dolphin wants, right, is different from what a human wants.
Yeah.
And it's like I have a dog, right? And so I'm sitting here, I'm scratching my dog's belly, and I'm like, I don't know what you're getting out of this, but I hope it's nothing creepy. and so, you know, it's certainly possible that they're through generations of dolphin trainers, you know, cuddling and scratching dolphins that somehow they got the wrong idea about it.
Maybe.
Yeah. The dolphins are like, hey, these humans led us on for years, maybe centuries.
What did you think about the dolphin languages?
So I'm kind of two minds about this, because this is kind of where I land on the entire series thus far. Is I feel like the science fiction ideas are fantastic, but some of their implementation I don't love. So with the dolphins, I love the idea that, you know, they developed language differently than we did, because they have they have the primal dolphin language, which, you know, we know that they have some kind of communication now, even now, in present day. Does it rise to the level of a language? I'm not smart enough to say. But the idea that as they increased in intelligence, that primal language would continue in there and turn into a language makes some amount of sense. And so then that kind of gets, it's like, you know, I'm interested in linguistics. And so in, when you have a contact between human cultures, like in the colonial times, right? You'd have the French come into Haiti, and there are natives there who have their own language, and the French speak French. And at some point, they're going to figure out how to talk to each other. And generally, that happens in a pidgin, where it's a very simplification of usually the more dominant language, the people who are in power. And as that continues, you eventually develop a grammar around it, which becomes what we call a Creole. And that's an actual language. And so that's where you get something like Haitian Creole. And so I kind of see the transition that he draws here in the book from the kind of dolphin primal into that trinary. Is that what the language was?
Yep.
Which is a kind of a shared language that humans can learn to communicate in, because I don't think the humans can communicate in primal.
No. And the dolphins find it very difficult to speak Anglic, so they meet somewhere in the middle with trinary.
Right. Yeah, and so the humans will whistle to the dolphins, and the dolphins will whistle back to them. I have to admit that I have a very, very low patience threshold for poetry in my prose fiction. And so all the haiku and stuff in this, I'm like, I don't like it. On the other hand, I totally hear what you were saying earlier about the different sides of the dolphins and how one side is kind of more metaphorical. And so it totally makes sense that they might speak in poetry, because there's layers of meaning there. But I'm a much more kind of logical person, and I want something straightforward. And the dolphin poems are not that.
Yeah. I didn't mind them reading them, I think just because my eyes flew over them, but I can imagine how annoying that would become in the audio version of the book.
Yeah.
The other thing is with the dolphin languages is that they kind of I like that at the start, I kind of shared that opinion with you that it was a bit annoying. And then the further you get into the book, that the way that it's formatted into this weird little haiku, that actually kind of becomes part of the plot. So you have trinary, like the dolphins regressing back into their trinary. So that's formatted differently, regressing back into primal, sorry. That's different from when they're speaking trinary. And then you have these other languages emerge later on, where like the natives, the primitive little, like the fish people, and then later on something else deep in the ocean. Like how that kind of progressed, and we don't even get a resolution completely to that plot line. Like what does it mean for these languages? And I think Kredecky kind of starts to explore that, whereas when he has his brain injury and starts to speak to this thing beneath in that kind of metaphorical dreamlike language. Like, are dolphins able to transcend something that humans can't? Is it wrong for humans have to uplifted them in this direction? Should they have always been going in a different direction?
Right. Yeah. And that's where we get into the ethics of uplift, right? How are we to know that, you know, fast forward a couple hundred million years, what happens with dolphins, right? Do they branch off into a couple different species where one stays very much like you know, the current dolphins we have, and then other ones gain sapiency on their own, but differently than we would. So it's an interesting question.
Yeah. And I think definitely, at least my interpretation was that perhaps humans have stolen something from the dolphins by forcing them in this direction, not just with the language, like the logical version of the language, but stealing something from this dreamscape, like taking them away from that and bringing them into our reality. Like perhaps there were better advancements to be made in that dreamlike realm of the whale dream.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an interesting thought. Kind of when I was thinking of uplift, I was thinking about the process of uplifting a species and then educating them. So much of human education is about, you know, human history, and our literature is inextricably linked to our history as a species. And so the idea that could a dolphin read A Tale of Two Cities and really understand it, you know, or Frankenstein, they might actually get something out of, because there's an idea of uplift there almost, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good comparison, actually.
Yeah.
No, I totally get it. And I think that's kind of where he was going with it as well, at least from like a message perspective. Like if you, going back to what you were saying about different cultures, like it's not just about language, but also about history as well. So if you go into a culture that isn't familiar with your history and you start to educate them, and your basis for education is your history, that what is that going to do to a people? Like it's going to change them like down to their foundations, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, and you get into the question too of how does science education work? Because, you know, we have 10 fingers. Is that why we use a base 10 number system, you know? Does that make sense for dolphins?
Yeah, that's interesting to think about.
Yeah. I definitely thought, and kind of the more I think about this, the more I'm definitely enjoying talking about the book, because the thing that I like about it is the big ideas. And so I really did enjoy the kind of unfolding mystery of what's going on this planet, because we get the idea, I think we're told straight out from it's either the library or whatever the library thing on board the Streaker was called. And I can't remember what it was called.
The NIS machine.
Yes. The NIS machine, that this planet had been kind of a retirement planet for a sophant species that had gone there to kind of live out their convalescence and then go extinct, which I don't even understand how that works. Who says, oh, you guys are on your way out. You go ahead and take this world. It's yours. We'll check back on you in a few million years and see if there's anything left. And I like the idea that the species went there and they didn't just quietly go away, but there's some deeper mystery that, you know, we don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah. And that's flipped as well with the primitive species that's starting to evolve there naturally as well. And I think that's one of the main things that I keep coming back to that I like about this book, is that it explores a lot of these big, interesting ideas, like you were saying, but always from this binary perspective. So you have like the whale dream with Kredeki and Katharjon, and then you have like this planet with like a really old evolved species and an emerging one. And then you have dolphins and apes and like all of these binaries that keep popping up. And I think that, like, you know, binaries aren't the best way of exploring ideas. There are better ways, but it's interesting that the more you kind of like scrabble through, like crawl through the book, like these kind of keep popping up, these two extremes of every idea that he's kind of exploring.
Yeah. It's interesting too, the idea that here we have, you know, Kithrop is this planet that has this primitive species that the humans, of course, would like to lay claim to uplift. And so would all of the other galactics that are out there. Cause you know, they can always use more servant species, right? Client species, I guess is the polite term, but let's call it what it is. They're really slave species. But then the idea too, that's not the only intelligence on this planet. And I do like the fact that, after Kredeki's injury and he's no longer able to, speak in the same way, that somehow like his reversion to a more primal state is what connects him to this deeper thing that's going on Kithrop.
Yeah. Yeah, that was I think the most engaging plotline for me, the Krudecki or plotline, especially like some of that dreaming stuff that he's doing even before he has his injury.
Yeah,
I wasn't exactly sure what that was supposed to be. Was he psychically connecting to somebody else, or is that just the way that they sleep, right, or is there something more to it than that? That was very interesting to read because it kind of gave that extra dimension to dolphins. And I think there was always that risk that dolphins would just kind of be humans that swim. And I think that that whole whale dream idea kind of helps avoid that.
Yeah. I thought that the reveal of what Cathar John was great. That I did not catch on to right away. It was something that I thought, oh, okay, now that makes sense. Although, honestly, I thought they were going the direction of he was a shark.
Yes, me too.
But it makes more sense in terms of, biologically, dolphins and orcas are much closer than dolphins and sharks. Even though there's kind of the convergent evolution thing going, right, where they inhabit a similar niche, and so they look very similar in broad strokes to sharks, but they're very, really vastly different because one's an air breather and one's a water breather.
Yeah, I'd never really thought about that either. It kind of makes that really exciting towards the end because it's like, what does a dolphin fear? A shark, but he's not a shark. He kind of thinks of himself as a shark, but he's an orca. So it kind of, definitely creates an interesting dynamic at the end there.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I find interesting about the series as a whole is the whole idea of the progenitors and the suspicion that the rest of the races of sophants, the way they view humans as, like I said before, these upstarts who claim to have no patron. And they're like, we don't believe any species can evolve intelligence on its own, but it turns into kind of an infinite regression, right? Because who uplifted the progenitors? And is that a question that they all want the answer to? I don't know.
It's very interesting. And it's sort of one of these ideas that I guess I've kind of struggled with all my life as well. Like any kind of creation, I guess, system, or what came before that? Like you can make it religious if you want to, but very much in this, like who uplifted the progenitors, like you were saying, like did they just evolve naturally or was there something beyond them? Was it a deity? Was it a god? I don't know. Was this book challenging at all for you in that perspective?
No, not really. I mean, the only challenge there for me, I think, is with the idea of uplift. As a theist, I kind of do have a belief in human exceptionalism, right? That there's something immaterial in humans that's different that maybe we can't give other species. But I'm not sure how strongly I hold to that idea. I kind of tentatively, I reach toward it, but I'm not certain about that. And I kind of, as someone who accepts evolution too, I'm like, well, we're just kind of hairless, pretty smart apes. And so maybe there isn't anything exceptional. Maybe it's just you get to a certain brain size and you have what we would call a mind, right? And that gets into the whole discussion of mind-brain duality, right? Is it is the mind just part of the brain? Is it something separate? Is there a soul? Is there a spirit? And it's, I'm the kind of person who is comfortable with those kind of questions and doubts. And so I find it exciting.
Yeah, I feel like I keep saying, I feel like there's a bunch of ideas that David Brin was trying to message with this book. A lot of them are like socio-political, and I think that's one of them. What makes a soul? And he's, I think, fairly clearly saying that there is no such thing as a soul. It's just linked to intelligence. And that has implications for how we treat not only animals, but because they might one day be sentient just like us. So there's no difference between us and animals. But also, I think in a sort of a weird way, how we treat other cultures. Like just because they're not advanced as us right now doesn't mean they won't be later on. Like if you treat somebody badly, maybe then they'll become the humans and then wreck everything for you later on.
Right. Other things you want to talk about in spoiler talk?
I think we've covered all of my notes, everything that I had for notes. Okay. I wanted to talk about Metz a little bit. We kind of covered his position through talking about the idea more generally rather than his character specifically.
Dr. Metz is the one who's actually experimenting on the dolphins, yes, right? Creating the... Yep. I can't remember what they were called.
Tersiops and Stenos.
Right. That was it. Where the, like, Cathar John and, was it, Takata Jim are just, they're kind of scarier than the other Neofins.
Yeah.
I just kind of pictured them as bigger and brawnier.
Yeah. It's weird, right? Like, we're going to make dolphins. We're going to make Neo dolphins, but let's make one group that are bigger and stronger, and let's make other ones that they're just the ones that we don't really care that much about.
Right.
So that was kind of, that kind of thought process felt a bit weird for me. Like, why wouldn't he then use that? Maybe that was just the default branch, and then this is my, like, the group that I'm testing something weird on, which I guess is what he was doing, but it just kind of feels weird as you're reading it.
Yeah, it does, but I mean, it brings up the question of, if you were going to uplift a species, is it right to have a particular trajectory in mind, or is it more almost ethical to say, okay, let's try five different things and see which, you know, bears fruit and which, but then of course we're judging that by our human standards too.
Yeah, that's true. Huh. The other thing that I thought of that we should probably talk about was the whole subplot with Tom Orley. So he's kind of like an evolution. He's even like the mentee of Jacob Denwa from the first book. And he's kind of like the action hero of this book. Right. He goes out and he does everything. Did you find it as offensive as the Jacob Denwa stuff in the first one?
I wouldn't say offensive.
Or on the nose, I guess.
Oh, that he was almost an author proxy?
Yeah.
or he was the Indiana Jones of the book?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I guess it reminded me of just kind of, it reminded me of the 80s, you know, kind of your MacGyver character or your you know, lantern-jawed hero, you know, Rambo or any number of those characters from the 80s. Almost an archetype, right?
Yeah. I think it's like, I was still annoyed by it, but not as much as I was the first one, because he kind of just goes off and does his own thing. And I think that it's fairly heavily signposted, at least towards the start of the book, that like, he's one of Earth's best people, and that's why he's here, because he's a problem solver and he can go and do all this magical stuff. So like, when he's off like swimming underwater and like popping up and like shooting aliens in the head and doing all of this ridiculous stuff, it's like, ah, okay, I guess that, like, let's just let David Brin have his action hero.
Right. There's even a musing in there about that maybe Jillian would have been the better person to send out here, but, you know, she's the little lady and he had to protect her. And on the other hand, she's a lot more competent than he is in a lot of other ways. And yes. So I like the fact that she did kind of get her moment to shine when she sort of became the de facto captain, but it was almost by default toward the end.
Yeah, it's because you're the highest ranking human. Oh, I guess it needs to be you, Jillian. All right, here you go. You're the captain now.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But then she got to go and rescue Tom, right?
Yes.
Or did she? I can't remember how he ended up.
No, the side boat, they send out the side boat, or it's left behind, right, and then they pick him up right before they go off to try and meet up with the others.
Right. Yeah, so I'll be interested to check out the Uplift War at some point and just see, you know, I have no idea how connected it is to this one or if it's in another, you know, 150 years after this.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
But I don't know. I'm sure somebody on Twitter will let me know if the book picks up 100 years later or if it's, you know, right after the events of this book or something.
Yeah. Did I have any impact on your opinion?
You did. I mean, kind of in the way that that having a conversation about a book where you've only had your own thoughts bouncing around your head for a while, that it's almost always going to raise the prestige or, you know, my view of a book just talking to somebody else about it who has different thoughts. So no, I appreciate that. I'm not going to put this near the top of my list in terms of my favorite ones that I read. But there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I'm very grateful that you helped bring some of it out.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Well, so let's go into final thoughts. That kind of suffices for mine, right? This isn't one of my favorites that I've read, but it was interesting. You know, the ideas are large enough that I can kind of, I can totally see why this won the Hugo and the Nebula. It completely makes sense. Just because it's not exactly my cup of tea does not mean it's not a good book. So What about you? Final thoughts?
I feel like this book was kind of always going to go well for me. It kind of sits within the niche of stuff that I like. I like those epic sprawling space operas, but I like them to be contained in a small group of people and how that group of people deals with the shenanigans that are going on universe-wide. So that was kind of targeted at me in that way. But I also liked exploring the idea of like the whale dream for me, I think was the big thing that kind of kept me reading and drew me through. So I really liked it. It's probably not in the top 10 books I've ever read, but yeah, definitely one of the top Hugo winners that I've read so far.
Nice. It's funny because in the few notes that I took down, one of the items I had was just whale dream ? And like I had just been kind of confused by it. And so hearing you talk about it just in this conversation has kind of made me go, okay, yeah, that was pretty cool. So before we sign off, why don't you tell me about this podcast that you've been working on and when we're going to see it or hear it and where people can find you.
Cool. So it's a kind of a politically based podcast. Our previous podcasts always kind of delved into exploring these weird political ideas and the stuff that we were watching and exploring. So we decided to just like, let's just drop the pretense of talking about TV shows and let's just talk about politics. So it's called Outside the Overton Window. It's about ideas that are not necessarily acceptable to talk about or discuss in public conversation and discussing why or why aren't those ideas acceptable. So we've done political ideas such as like libertarianism and left-leaning populism, but we've also we're also going to do some lifestyle ideas as well, so stuff like sex robots and furries. So anything that you can't really talk about in public,
right? So nothing is going to be taboo on your podcast.
No, and we kind of want to get into the conspiracy stuff as well, but hopefully it all goes well. But that starts in February. So if you're listening to this in February onwards, you should be able to find us at Beyond the Overton Window.
Cool. Yeah, I'll definitely look for that. And when you get it up and running, if you have social media, we'll make sure to hook up and I'll retweet and make sure people know about it.
Cool. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Joe, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. It was a great conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a while because I don't like the feeling of not enjoying a book as much as, you know, kind of the rest of humanity, apparently. So I really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you. I've really appreciated discussing it with you.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk down the line. So Joy. Joy. Try that again. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Joe, and I will make sure to put a plug out on social media for his new podcast when it comes out. You may have noticed my voice has changed since the actual discussion with Joe. It's because I forgot to record the outro right afterwards, and then shortly thereafter, over the holidays, got sick, and I'm just getting over that. But I wanted to come back and do this tag for the episode. One thing that I want to put in here is actually a cross promotion for a podcast that I've discovered recently called Online Warriors, so I'm going to drop that in right now.
Hey everybody, this is Nerd Bomber here, one of the co-hosts of the Online Warriors podcast. Our weekly podcast started as a way for three friends to keep in touch and discuss their passion for movies, gaming, technology, and entertainment. And since then, we've grown into a fantastic online community. Every Wednesday, we release a new episode discussing the latest nerdy news, and then we go hands-on with our weekly adventures and a fun trivia show. Sound interesting? Check us out on every podcast platform, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or hit us up at onlinewarriorspodcast.com.
Alrighty, so if everything works out, I'm trying to get Nerd Bomber to actually come on to the podcast. So we'll see about doing that sometime next year. But I do encourage you to go check out the Online Warriors podcast. It's something that I've been enjoying recently. So I think you will too if you're nerdy and if you're listening to this podcast. I know you are. I do want to encourage you, if you would like to support the work that I'm doing here and on my other podcasts, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's podcast and sign up to support for as little as $1 an episode. I'm starting to think about what kind of patron-only content that I want to have because I'm getting close to the actual goal that I set for that. So I will be posting some stuff in the patron-only feed, and there's only a few people right now in there who are going to be seeing that content. So if you want to see it, or hear it, I guess in this case, make sure to sign up. If you can't support financially, you know, do everything you can non-financially, you know, retweet the episodes, tell your friends, you know, recommend this podcast to your nerdy friends. And follow me on social media, of course, at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter. And actually, the username is Hugo's Podcast everywhere. So that'll do it for this time. And I will talk to you next month. Just occurred to me, actually, this is the first podcast of 2020. So welcome to 2020. Happy New Year, everybody. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.